I woke myself up with such a god-awful jerk that I almost fell out of bed myself. It was early morning with the first sun laying across the floor in a stripe. Vera was still sleeping. She drooled all over my arm. But at first I didn't have the strength to wipe it off. I just laid there, trembling, all covered with sweat, trying to make myself believe I was really awake and things was really all right. The way you do, you know, after a really bad nightmare. And for a second there, I could still see that dust head with its big, empty eyes and long, dusty teeth laying on the floor beside the bed. That's how bad the dream was. Then it was gone. The floor and the corners of the room were as clean and empty as always. But I've always wondered since then if maybe she didn't send me that dream. If I didn't see a little of what she saw those times when she screamed. Maybe I picked up a little of her fear and made it my own. You think things like that ever happen in real life? Or only in those cheap newspapers they sell down to the grocery? I don't know. But I know that dream scared the bejesus out of me. Well, never mind. Suffice it to say that screaming her friggin' head off on Sunday afternoons and in the middle of the night was the third way she had of being a bitch. But it was a sad, sad thing all the same. All her bitchiness was sad at the bottom, although that didn't stop me from sometimes wanting to spin her head around like a spool on a spindle. And I think anybody but Saint Joan of friggin' art would have felt the same. I guess when Susie and Shauna heard me yelling that day that I'd like to kill her, or when other people heard me, or heard us yelling mean things at each other, well, they must have thought I'd hike up my skirts and tap dance on her grave when she finally give over. And I imagine you've heard from some of them yesterday and today, haven't you, Andy? No need to answer. All the answer I need's right there on your face. It's a regular billboard. Besides, I know how people love to talk. They talked about me and Vera, and there was a country fair amount of globber about me and Joe, too. Some before he died and even more after. Out here in the boondocks, about the most interesting thing a person can do is die sudden. Did you ever notice that? So here we are at Joe. I've been dreading this part, and I guess there's no use lying about it. I already told you I killed him, so that's over with. But the hard part is still all ahead. How and why and when it had to be. I've been thinking about Joe a lot today, Andy. More about him than about Vera, truth to tell. I kept trying to remember just why I married him in the first place, for one thing. And at first I couldn't do it. After a while, I got into a kind of panic about it, like Vera when she'd get the idea there was a snake inside her pillow slip. Then I realized what the trouble was. I was looking for the love part, like I was one of those foolish little girls Vera used to hire in June and then fire before the summer was halfway done because they couldn't keep to her rules. I was looking for the love part, and there was precious little of that even back in 1945, when I was 18 and he was 19 and the world was new. You know, the only thing that come to me while I was out there on the steps today, freezing my tuchus off and trying to remember about the love part? He had a nice forehead. I sat near him in study hall back when we was in high school together, during World War II, that was, and I remember his forehead, how smooth it looked, without a single pimple on it. There was some on his cheeks and chin, and he was prone to blackheads on the sides of his nose, but his forehead looked as smooth as cream. I remember wanting to touch it, dreaming about touching it, to tell the truth, wanting to see if it was as smooth as it looked. And when he asked me to the junior-senior prom, I said yes, and I got my chance to touch his forehead, and it was every bit as smooth as it looked, with his hair going back from it in these nice smooth waves. Me stroking his hair and his smooth forehead in the dark while the band inside the ballroom of the Samoset Inn played Moonlight Cocktail. After a few hours of sitting on those damn rickety steps and shivering, that came back to me at least. So you see, there was a little something there after all. Of course, I found myself touching a lot more than just his forehead before too many more weeks had passed, and that was where I made my mistake. Now let's get one thing straight. I ain't trying to say I ended up spending the best years of my life with that old rumpot just because I liked the look of his forehead in Period 7 study hall when the light came slanting in on it. Shit, no. But I am trying to tell you that's all the love part I was able to remember today. And that makes me feel bad. Sitting out on the stairs today by the east head, thinking over those old times. That was damned hard work. It was the first time I saw that I might have sold myself cheap. And maybe I did it because I thought cheap was the best the likes of me could expect to get for herself. I know it was the first time I dared to think that I deserved to be loved more than Joe St. George could love anybody, except himself, maybe. You mightn't think a hard-talking old bitch like me believes in love, but the truth is, it's just about the only thing I do believe in. It didn't have much to do with why I married him, though. I gotta tell you that straight out. I had 6 weeks' worth of baby girl in my belly when I told him I did and I would, until death do us part. And that was the smartest part of it, sad but true. The rest of it was all the usual stupid reasons. And one thing I've learned in my life is that stupid reasons make stupid marriages. I was tired of fighting with my mother. I was tired of being scolded by my father. All my friends was doing it. They was getting homes of their own, and I wanted to be a grown-up like them. I was tired of being a silly little girl. He said he wanted me, and I believed him. He said he loved me, and I believed that, too. And after he'd said it and asked me if I felt the same for him, it only seemed polite to say I did. I was scared of what would happen to me if I didn't. Where I'd have to go, what I'd have to do, who'd look after my baby while I was doing it. All that's going to look pretty silly if you ever write it up, Nancy. But the silliest thing is I know a dozen women who were girls I went to school with who got married for those same reasons. And most of them are still married, and a good many of them are only holding on, hoping to outlive the old man so they can bury him and then shake his beer farts out of the sheets forever. By 1952 or so, I'd pretty well forgotten his forehead. And by 1956, I didn't have much use for the rest of him either. And I guess I'd started hating him by the time Kennedy took over from Ike. But I never had a thought of killing him till later. I thought I'd stay with him because my kids needed a father, if for no other reason. Ain't that a laugh? But it's the truth, I swear it is. And I swear something else as well. If God gave me a second chance, I'd kill him again. Even if it meant hellfire and damnation forever, which it probably does. I guess everybody on Little Tall who ain't a Johnny come lately knows I killed him. And most of them probably think they know why, because of the way he had of using his hands on me. But it wasn't his hands on me that brought him to grief. And the simple truth is that no matter what people on the island might have thought at the time, he never hit me a single lick during the last 3 years of our marriage. I cured him of that foolishness in late 1960 or early 61. Up until then, he hit me quite a lot, yes. I can't deny it. And I stood for it. I can't deny that either. The first time was the second night of the marriage. We'd gone down to Boston for the weekend. That was our honeymoon. And stayed at the Parker House. Hardly went out the whole time. We was just a couple of country mice, you know, and afraid we'd get lost. Joe said he was damned if he was going to spend the $25 my folks had given us for mad money on a taxi ride just because he couldn't find his way back to the hotel. Gory, what, that man dumb. Of course, I was, too. But one thing Joe had that I didn't, and I'm glad of it, too, was that everlasting suspicious nature of his. He had the idea the whole human race was out to do him dirty, Joe did. And I've thought plenty of times that when he did get drunk, maybe it was because it was the only way he could go to sleep without leaving one eye open. Well, that ain't neither here nor there. What I set out to tell you was that we went down to the dining room that Saturday night, had a good dinner, and then went back up to our room again. Joe was listening considerably to starboard on the walk down the hall, I remember. He'd had 4 or 5 beers with his dinner and another 9 or 10 over the course of the afternoon. Once we were inside the room, he stood there looking at me so long, I asked him if he saw anything green. No, he says, but I seen a man down there in that restaurant looking up your dress, Dolores. His eyes were just about hanging out on springs, and you knew he was looking, didn't you? I almost told him Gary Cooper could have been sitting in the corner with Rita Hayworth, and I wouldn't have known it. And then thought, why bother? It didn't do any good to argue with Joe when he'd been drinking. I didn't go into that marriage with my eyes entirely shut, and I'm not going to try to kid you that I did. If there was a man looking up my dress, why didn't you go over and tell him to shut his eyes, Joe? I asked. It was only a joke. Maybe I was trying to turn him aside. I really don't remember. But he didn't take it as a joke. That I do remember. Joe wasn't a man to take a joke. In fact, I'd have to say he had almost no sense of humor at all. That was something I didn't know going into it with him. I thought back then that a sense of humor was like a nose or a pair of ears, that some worked better than others, but everybody had one. He grabbed me and turned me over his knee and paddled me with his shoe. For the rest of your life, nobody's going to have any idea what color underwear you got on but me, Dolores, he said. You hear that? Nobody but me. I actually thought it was a kind of love play, him pretending to be jealous, to flatter me. That's what a little ninny I was. It was jealousy, all right, but love had nothing to do with it. It was more like the way a dog will put a paw over his bone and growl if you come too near it. I didn't know that then, so I put up with it. Later on, I put up with it because I thought a man hitting his wife from time to time was only another part of being married. Not a nice part, but then cleaning toilets ain't a nice part of being married either. But most women have done their fair share of it after the bridal dress and veil have been packed away in the attic. Ain't they, Nancy? My own dad used his hands on my mum from time to time. And I suppose that was where I got the idea that it was all right. Just something to be put up with. I loved my dad dearly, and him and her loved each other dearly. But he could be a handsy kind of man when he had a hair laying just right across his ass. I remember one time, I must have been, I'm going to say 9 years old, when Dad came in from haying George Richards Field over on the West End, and Mum didn't have his dinner on. I can't remember any more why she didn't, but I remember real well what happened when he came in. He was wearing only his bibballs. He'd taken his work boots and socks off out on the stoop because they were full of chaff. And his face and shoulders was burned bright red. His hair was sweated against his temples, and there was a piece of hay stuck to his forehead right in the middle of the lines that waved across his brow. He looked hot and tired and ready to be pissed off. He went into the kitchen, and there wasn't nothing on the table but a glass pitcher with flowers in it. He turns to Mum and says, "Where's my supper, dummy?" She opened her mouth, but before she could say anything, he put his hand over her face and pushed her down in the corner. I was standing in the kitchen entry and seen it all. He come walking toward me with his head lowered and his hair kind of hanging in his eyes. Whenever I see a man walking home that way, tired out from his day of work and his dinner bucket in his hand, it makes me think of my dad. And I was some scared. I wanted to get out of his way because I felt he would push me down too. But my legs was too heavy to move. He never, though. He just took hold of me with his big, warm, hard hands and set me aside and went out back. He sat down on the chopping block with his hands in his lap and his head hung down like he was looking at them. He scared the chickens away at first, but they come back after a while and started pecking all around his shoes. I thought he'd kick out at them, make the feathers fly, but he never done that either. After a while, I looked around at my mum. She was still sitting in the corner. She'd put a dish towel over her face and was crying underneath it. Her arms were crossed over her bosom. That's what I remember best of all, though I don't know why. How her arms were crossed over her bosom like that. I went over and hugged her, and she felt her arms around my middle and hugged me back. Then she took the dish towel off her face and used it to wipe her eyes and told me to go out back and ask Daddy if he wanted a glass of cold lemonade or a bottle of beer. "Be sure to tell him there's only 2 bottles of beer," she said. "If he wants more than that, he'd better go to the store or not get started at all." I went out and told him, and he said he didn't want no beer, but a glass of lemonade would hit the spot. I ran to fetch it. Mum was getting his supper. Her face was still kind of swole from crying, but she was humming a tune. And that night they bounced the bedsprings just like they did most nights. Nothing else was ever said or made of it. That sort of thing was called home correction in those days. It was part of a man's job. And if I thought of it afterward at all, I only thought that my mum must have needed some, or Dad never would have done what he did. There was a few other times I saw him correct her, but that's the one I remember best. I never saw him hit her with his fist, like Joe sometimes hit me. But once he stropped her across the legs with a piece of wet canvas sailcloth, and that must have hurt like a bastard. I know it left red marks that didn't go away all afternoon. No one calls it home correction anymore. The term has passed right out of conversation, so far as I can tell, and good riddance. But I grew up with the idea that when women and children step off the straight and narrow, it's a man's job to herd them back onto it. I ain't trying to tell you that just because I grew up with the idea, I thought it was right, though. I won't let myself slip off that easy. I knew that a man using his hands on a woman didn't have much to do with correction. But I let Joe go on doing it to me for a long time just the same. I guess I was just too tired from keeping house, cleaning for the summer people, raising my family, and trying to clean up Joe's messes with the neighbors to think much about it. Being married to Joe, oh, shit. What's any marriage like? I guess they are all different ways, but there ain't one of them that's what it looks like from the outside, I can tell you that. What people see of a married life and what actually goes on inside it are usually not much more than kissing cousins. Sometimes that's awful, and sometimes it's funny. But usually it's like all the other parts of life, both things at the same time. What people think is that Joe was an alcoholic who used to beat me, and probably the kids too, when he was drunk. They think he finally did it once too often and I punched his ticket for it. It's true that Joe drank, and that he sometimes went to the AA meetings over in Jonesport, but he was no more an alcoholic than I am. He'd throw a drunk every 4 or 5 months, mostly with trash like Jerry Thibodeau or Stevie Brooks. Those men really were alcoholics. But then he'd leave it alone except for a nip or two when he came in at night. No more than that, because when he had a bottle, he liked to make it last. The real alkies I've known in my time, none of them was interested in making a bottle of anything last. Not Jim Beam or Old Duke, not even DeRail, which is antifreeze strained through cotton batten. A real drunk is only interested in two things, putting paid to the jug in the hand and hunting for the one still in the bush. No, he wasn't an alcoholic, but he didn't mind if people thought he'd been one. It helped him get work, especially in the summer. I guess the way people think about Alcoholics Anonymous has changed over the years. I know they talk about it a lot more than they used to. But one thing that hasn't changed is the way people will try to help somebody who claims he's already gone to work helping himself. Joe spent one whole year not drinking, or at least not talking about it when he did. And they had a party for him over in Jonesport. Gave him a cake and a medallion, they did. So when he went for a job one of the summer people needed done, the first thing he'd tell him was that he was a recovering alcoholic. If you don't want to hire me because of that, I won't have any hard feelings, he'd say. But I have to get it off my chest. I've been going to AA meetings for over a year now, and they tell us we can't stay sober if we can't be honest. And then he'd pull out his gold one-year medallion and show it to him, all the while looking like he hadn't had nothing to eat but humble pie for a month of Sundays. I guess one or two of them just about cried when Joe told him about how he was working it a day at a time and taking it easy and letting go and letting God whenever the urge for a drink hit him, which it did about every 15 minutes, according to him. They'd usually fall all over themselves taking him on, and at 50 cents or even a dollar an hour more than they'd intended to pay, like as not. You'd have thought the gimmick would have fallen flat after Labor Day, but it worked amazingly well even here on the island, where people saw him every day and should have known better. The truth is, most of the times Joe hit me, he was cold sober. When he had his skin full, he didn't much mind me at all, one way or the other. Then in 60 or 61, he come in one night after helping Charlie Dispensieri get his boat out of the water. And when he bent over to get a Coke out of the fridge, I seen his britches were split right up the back. I laughed. I couldn't help myself. He didn't say nothing. But when I went over to the stove to check on the cabbage, I was making a boiled dinner that night, I remember like it was yesterday. He got a chunk of rock maple out of the wood box and whacked me in the small of the back with it. Oh, that hurt. You know what I mean if anyone's ever hit you in the kidneys? It makes them feel small and hot and so heavy, like they're going to bust loose from whatever holds them where they're supposed to be, and they'll just sink, like lead shot in a bucket. I hobbled as far as the table and sat in one of the chairs. I would have fallen on the floor if that chair had been any further away. I just sat there, waiting to see if the pain was going to pass. I didn't cry exactly because I didn't want to scare the kids, but the tears went rolling down my face just the same. I couldn't stop them. They were tears of pain, the kind you can't hold back for anybody or anything. "Don't you ever laugh at me, you bitch," Joe says. He slung the stove length he hit me with back into the wood box, then sat down to read the American. "You ought to have known better than that 10 years ago." It was 20 minutes before I could get out of that chair. I had to call Selina to turn down the heat under the veg and the meat, even though the stove wasn't but 4 steps away from where I was sitting. "Why didn't you do it, Mommy?" she asked me. "I was watching cartoons with Joey." "I'm resting," I told her. "That's right," Joe says from behind his paper. "She ran her mouth until she got all tuckered out." And he laughed. That did it. That one laugh was all it took. I decided right then he wasn't never going to hit me again, unless he wanted to pay a dear price for it. We had supper just like usual, and watched the TV just like usual afterward. Me and the big kids on the sofa, and little Pete on his father's lap in the big easy chair. Pete dozed off there, same as he almost always did, around 7:30, and Joe carried him to bed. I sent Joan Jr. an hour later, and Selina went at 9. I usually turned in around 10, and Joe'd sit up until maybe midnight, dozing in and out, watching a little TV, reading parts of the paper he'd missed the first time, and picking his nose. So you see, Frank, you're not so bad. Some people never lose the habit, even when they grow up. That night, I didn't go to bed when I usually did. I sat up with Joe instead. My back felt a little better. Good enough to do what I had to do, anyway. Maybe I was nervous about it, but if I was, I don't recall. I was mostly waiting for him to doze off, and finally he did. I got up, went into the kitchen, and got the little cream pitcher off the table. I didn't go out looking for that special. It was only there because it was Joe Jr.'s night to clean off the table, and he'd forgotten to put it in the refrigerator. Joe Jr. always forgot something. To put away the cream pitcher, to put the glass top on the butter dish, to fold the bread wrapper under so the first slice wouldn't get all hard overnight. And now when I see him on the TV news, making a speech or giving an interview, that's what I'm most apt to think about. I wonder what the Democrats would think if they knew the majority leader of the Maine State Senate couldn't never manage to get the kitchen table completely cleared off when he was 11. I'm proud of him, though, and don't you ever, ever think any different. I'm proud of him, even if he is a goddamn Democrat. Anyway, he sure managed to forget the right thing that night. It was little, but it was heavy, and it felt just right in my hand. I went over to the wood box, and I got the short-handled hatchet we kept on the shelf just above it. Then I walked back into the living room where he was dozing. I had the pitcher cupped in my right hand, and I just brought it down and around and smacked it against the side of his face. It broke into about 1,000 pieces. He sat up pretty pert when I done that, Andy. And you should have heard him. Loud, Father God and Sonny Jesus. Sounded like a bull with his pizzle caught in the garden gate. His eyes come wide open, and he clapped his hand to his ear, which was already bleeding. There was little dots of clotted cream on his cheek, and then that scraggle down the side of his face he called a sideburn. "Guess what, Joe," I says. "I ain't feeling tired anymore." I heard Selina jump out of bed, but I didn't dare look around. I could have been in hot water if I'd done that. When he wanted to, he could be sneaky fast. I'd been holding the hatchet in my left hand down to my side with my apron almost covering it, and when Joe started to get up out of his chair, I brought it out and showed it to him. "If you don't want this in your head, Joe, you better sit down again," I said. For a second, I thought he was going to get up anyway. If he had, that would have been the end of him right then, because I wasn't kidding. He seen it, too, and froze with his butt about 5 inches off the seat. "Mommy?" Selena called from the doorway of her room. "You go on back to bed, honey," I says, not taking my eyes off Joe for a single second. "Your father and I are having a little discussion here." "Is everything all right?"
"Yeah,"
I says. "Isn't it, Joe?"
"Uh-huh,"
he says, "right as rain." I heard her take a few steps back, but I didn't hear the door of her room close for a little while. 10, maybe 15 seconds. And I knew she was standing there and looking at us. Joe stayed just like he was, with one hand on the arm of his chair and his butt hiked up off of the seat. Then we heard her door close, and that seemed to make Joe realize how foolish he must look, half in his seat and half out of it, with his other hand clapped over his ear and little clots of cream dribbling down the side of his face. He sat all the way down and took his hand away. Both it and his ear were full of blood, but his hand wasn't swelling up and his ear was. "Oh, bitch, ain't you gonna get a payback," he says. "Am I?" I told him. "Well, then you better remember this, Joe St. George. What you pay out to me, you are gonna get back double." He was grinning at me like he couldn't believe what he was hearing. "Why, I guess I'll just have to kill you then, won't I?" I handed over the hatchet to him almost before the words were out of his mouth. It hadn't been in my mind to do it, but as soon as I seen him holding it, I knew it was the only thing I could have done. "Go on," I says. "Just make the first one count so's I don't have to suffer." He looked from me to the hatchet and then back to me again. The look of surprise on his face would have been comical if the business hadn't been so serious. "Then once it's done, you better heat up that boiled dinner and help yourself to some more of it," I told him. "Eat till you bust, because you'll be going to jail, and I ain't heard they serve anything good and home-cooked in jail. You'll be over in Belfast to start with, I guess. I bet they got one of those orange suits just your size." "Shut up, you cunt," he says. I wouldn't, though. "After that, you'll most likely be in Shawshank. And I know they don't bring your meals hot to the table there. They don't let you out Friday nights to play poker with your beer joint buddies either. All I ask is that you do it quick, and don't let the kids see the mess once it's over." Then I closed my eyes. I was pretty sure he wouldn't do it. But being pretty sure don't squeeze much water when it's your life on the line. That's one thing I found out that night. I stood there with my eyes shut, seeing nothing but dark, and wondering what it'd feel like having that hatchet come carving through my nose and lips and teeth. I remember thinking I'd most likely taste the wood splinters on the blade before I died, and I remember being glad I'd had it on the grindstone only 2 or 3 days before. If he was going to kill me, I didn't want it to be with a dull hatchet. Seemed like I stood there like that for about 10 years. Then he said, kind of gruff and pissed off, "Are you going to get ready for bed or just stand there like Helen Keller having a wet dream?" I opened my eyes and saw he'd put the hatchet under his chair. I could just see the end of the handle sticking out from under the flounce. His newspaper was laying on top of his feet in a kind of tent. He bent over, picked it up, and shook it out, trying to behave like it hadn't happened, none of it. But there was blood pouring down his cheek from his ear, and his hands were trembling just enough to make the pages of the paper rattle a tiny bit. He'd left his fingerprints in red on the front and back pages, too, and I made up my mind to burn the damn thing before he went to bed so the kids wouldn't see it and wonder what happened. "I'll be getting into my nightgown soon enough, but we're going to have an understanding on this first, Joe." He looks up and says, all tight-lipped, "You don't want to get too fresh, Dolores. That'd be a bad, bad mistake. You don't want to tease me." "I ain't teasing," I says. "Your days of hitting me are over, that's all I want to say. If you ever do it again, one of us is going to the hospital, or to the morgue." He looked at me for a long, long time, Andy, and I looked back at him. The hatchet was out of his hand and under the chair, but that didn't matter.
I knew that if I dropped my eyes before he did, the punches in the neck and the hits in the back wouldn't never end. But at long last, he looked down at his newspaper again and kind of muttered, "Make yourself useful, woman. Bring me a towel for my head if you can't do nothing else. I'm bleeding all over my goddamn shirt." That was the last time he ever hit me. He was a coward at heart, you see, although I never said the word out loud to him. Not then and not ever. Doing that's about the most dangerous thing a person can do, I think, because a coward is more afraid of being discovered than he is of anything else, even dying. Of course, I knew he had a yellow streak in him. I never would have dared hit him upside the face with that cream pitcher in the first place if I hadn't felt I had a pretty good chance of coming out on top. Besides, I realized something as I sat in that chair after he hit me, waiting for my kidneys to stop aching. If I didn't stand up to him then, I probably wouldn't ever stand up to him. So I did. You know, taking the cream pitcher to Joe was really the easy part. Before I could do it, I had to once and for all rise above the memory of my dad pushing my mum down, and of him stropping the backs of her legs with that length of wet sailcloth. Getting over those memories was hard, because I dearly loved them both. But in the end I was able to do it, probably because I had to do it. And I'm thankful I did, if only because Selina ain't never going to have to remember her mother sitting in the corner and bawling with a dish towel over her face. My mum took it when her husband dished it up, but I ain't going to sit in judgment of either of them. Maybe she had to take it, and maybe he had to dish it up or be belittled by the men he had to live and work with every day. Times were different back then. Most people don't realize how different. But that didn't mean I had to take it from Joe just because I'd been enough of a goose to marry him in the first place. There ain't no home correction in a man beating a woman with his fists or a stove length out of the wood box. And in the end, I decided I wasn't going to take it from the likes of Joe St. George or from the likes of any man. So he never hit me again. There were times when he raised a hand to do it, but then he'd think better of it. Sometimes when the hand was up, wanting to hit but not quite daring to hit, I'd see in his eyes that he was remembering the cream pitcher. Maybe the hatchet, too. And then he'd make like he only raised that hand because his head needed scratching or his forehead wiping. That was one lesson he got the first time, maybe the only one. There was something else come out of the night he hit me with a stove length and I hit him with the cream pitcher. I don't like to bring it up. I'm one of those old-fashioned folks that believes what goes on behind the bedroom door should stay there. But I guess I better, because it's probably part of why things turned out as they did. Although we were married and living under the same roof together for the next 2 years, and it might have been closer to three, I really can't remember, he only tried to take his privilege with me a few times after that. He... What, Andy? Of course I mean he was impotent. What else would I be talking about? His right to wear my underwear if the urge took him? I never denied him. He just quit being able to do it. He wasn't what you'd call an every-night sort of man, not even back at the start. And he wasn't one to draw it out, either. He was always pretty much wham-bam and thank you, ma'am. If I hadn't been a quick-heating sort of woman, I never would have gotten no pleasure out of it at all. Still and all, he'd stayed interested enough to climb on top once or twice a week. Until I hit him with the creamer, that is. Part of it was probably the booze. He was drinking a lot more during those last years. But I don't think that was all of it. No, sir, and no, ma'am. I remember him rolling off of me one night after about 20 minutes of useless puffing and blowing, and his little thing still just hanging there, limp as a noodle. I don't know how long after the night I just told you about this would have been, but I know it was after, because I remember laying there with my kidneys throbbing and thinking I'd get up pretty soon and take some aspirin to quiet them down. "There," he says, almost crying. "I hope you're satisfied, Dolores. Are you?" I didn't say nothing. Sometimes anything a woman says to a man is bound to be the wrong thing. "Are you?" he says. "Are you satisfied, Dolores?" I didn't say nothing still. Just laid there and looked up at the ceiling and listened to the wind outside. It was from the east that night, and I could hear the ocean in it. That's a sound I've always loved. It soothes me. He turned over, and I could smell his beer breath on my face, rank and sour. "Turning out the light used to help," he says, "but it don't no more. I can see your ugly face even in the dark." He reached out, grabbed my boob, and kind of shook it. "And this," he says, "all floppy and flat as a pancake. Your cunt's even worse. Christ, you ain't 35 yet and fucking use like fucking a mud puddle." I thought of saying if it was a mud puddle, you could stick it in soft, Joe, and wouldn't that relieve your mind? But I kept my mouth shut. Dolores Claiborne's mother didn't raise any fools, like I told you. There was some more quiet. I'd about decided he'd said enough mean things to finally send him off to sleep, and I was thinking about slipping out to get my aspirin when he spoke up again. And that time, I'm pretty sure he was crying. "I wish I'd never seen your face," he says. And then he says, "Why didn't you just use that friggin' hatchet to whack it off, Dolores? It would have come to the same." So, you see, I wasn't the only one that thought getting hit with the cream pitcher and being told things was going to change around the house might have had something to do with his problem. I still didn't say nothing, though. Just waited to see if he was going to go to sleep or try to use his hands on me again. He was laying there naked, and I knew the very first place I was going to go for if he did try. Pretty soon I heard him snoring. I don't know if that was the very last time he tried to be a man with me, but if it wasn't, it was close. None of his friends got so much as a whiff of these goings-on, of course. He sure as hell wasn't going to tell him his wife had whopped the bejesus out of him with a creamer and his weasel wouldn't stick up its head anymore, was he? Not him. So when the others had talked big about how they was handling their wives, he talked big right along with them, saying how he laid one on me for getting fresh with my mouth, or maybe for buying a dress over in Jonesport, without asking him first if it was all right to take money out of the cookie jar. How do I know? Why, because there are times when I can keep my ears open instead of my mouth. I know that's hard to believe, listening to me tonight, but it's true. I remember one time when I was working for the Marshalls. Remember Frank Marshall, Andy? How he was always talking about building a bridge over to the mainland? And the doorbell rang. I was all alone in the house, and I was hurrying to answer the door, and I slipped on a throw rug and fell hard against the corner of the mantel. It left a great big bruise on my arm, just above the elbow. About 3 days later, just when that bruise was going from dark brown to a kind of yellow-green like they do, I ran into Yvette Anderson in the village. She was coming out of the grocery, and I was going in. She looked at the bruise on my arm, and when she spoke to me, her voice was just dripping with sympathy. Only a woman who's just seen something that makes her happier than a pig in shit can drip that way. "Ain't men awful, Dolores," she says. "Well, sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't," I says back. I didn't have the slightest idea what she was talking about. What I was mostly concerned with was getting some of the pork chops that were on special that day before they were all gone. She pats me kind of gentle on the arm, the one that wasn't bruised, and says, "You be strong now. All things work for the best. I've been through it, and I know. I'll pray for you, Dolores." She said that last like she'd just told me she was going to give me $1 million, and then went on her way up street. I went into the market, still mystified. I would have thought she'd lost her mind, except anyone who's ever passed the time of day with Yvette knows she ain't got a whole hell of a lot to lose. I had my shopping half done when it hit me. I stood there watching Skippy Porter weigh my chops, my market basket over my arm and my head thrown back, laughing from way down deep inside my belly, the way you do when you know you can't do nothing but let her rip. Skippy looked round at me and says, "You all right, Mrs. Claiborne?" "I'm fine," I says. "I just thought of something funny," and off I went again. "I guess you did," Skippy says, and then he went back to his scales. God bless the porters, Andy. As long as they stay, there'll be at least one family on the island knows how to mind its business. Meantime, I just went on laughing. A few other people looked at me like I'd gone nuts, but I didn't care. Sometimes life is so goddamn funny you just have to laugh. Yvette's married to Tommy Anderson, of course. And Tommy was one of Joe's beer and poker buddies in the late 50s and early 60s. There'd been a bunch of them out at our place a day or two after I bruised my arm, trying to get Joe's latest bargain, an old Ford pick-em-up, running. It was my day off, and I brought them all out a pitcher of iced tea, mostly in hopes of keeping them off the suds at least till the sun went down. Tommy must have seen the bruise when I was pouring the tea. Maybe he asked Joe what happened after I left, or maybe he just remarked on it. Either way, Joe St. George wasn't a fella to let opportunity pass him by, not one like that, at least. Thinking it over on my way home from the market, the only thing I was curious about was what Joe told Tommy and the others I'd done. Forgot to put his bedroom slippers under the stove so they'd be warm when he stepped into them, maybe. Or cooked the beans too mushy on Saturday night. Whatever it was, Tommy went home and told Yvette that Joe St. George had needed to give his wife a little home correction. And all I'd ever done was bang off the corner of the Marshall's mantelpiece, running to see who was at the door. That's what I mean when I say there's two sides to a marriage, the outside and the inside. People on the island saw me and Joe like they saw most other couples our age. Not too happy, not too sad. Mostly just going along like two horses pulling a wagon. They may not notice each other like they once did, and they may not get along with each other as well as they once did when they do notice each other. But they're harnessed side by side and going down the road as well as they can just the same, not biting each other or lollygagging and doing any of the other things that draw the whip. But people aren't horses. Marriage ain't much like pulling a wagon, even though I know it sometimes looks that way on the outside. The folks on the island didn't know about the cream pitcher, or how Joe cried in the dark and said he wished he'd never seen my ugly face. Nor was that the worst of it. The worst didn't start until a year or so after we finished our doings in bed. It's funny, ain't it, how folks can look right at a thing and draw a completely wrong conclusion about why it happened. But it's natural enough, as long as you remember that the inside and outside of a marriage aren't usually much alike. What I'm going to tell you now was on the inside of ours, and until today I always thought it would stay there. Looking back, I think the trouble must have really started in 62. Selena'd just started high school over on the mainland. She had come on real pretty, and I remember that summer after her freshman year, she got along with her dad better than she had for the last couple of years. I'd been dreading her teenage years, foreseeing a lot of squabbles between the two of them as she grew up and started questioning his ideas and what he saw as his rights over her more and more. Instead, there was that little time of peace and quiet and good feelings between them, when she'd go out and watch him work on his old clunkers behind the house, or sit beside him on the couch while we were watching TV at night. Little Pete didn't think much of that arrangement, I can tell you. And ask him questions about his day during the commercials. He'd answer her in a calm, thoughtful way I wasn't used to. But I sort of remembered. From high school, I remembered it. Back when I was first getting to know him, and he was deciding that, yes, he wanted to court me. At the same time this was happening, she drew a distance away from me. Oh, she'd still do the chores I set her, and sometimes she'd talk about her day at school, but only if I went to work and pulled it out of her. There was a coldness that hadn't been there before, and it was only later on that I began to see how everything fit together, and how it all went back to the night she'd come out of her bedroom and seen us there, her dad with his hand clapped to his ear and blood running through the fingers, her mom standing over him with a hatchet. He was never a man to let certain kinds of opportunity pass him by, I told you, and this was just more of the same. He'd told Tommy Anderson one kind of story. The one he told his daughter was in a different pew but the same church. I don't think there was anything in his mind at first but spite. He knew how much I loved Selena, and he must have thought telling her how mean and bad-tempered I was, maybe even how dangerous I was, would be a fine piece of revenge. He tried to turn her against me, and while he never really succeeded at that, he did manage to get closer to her than he'd been since she was a little girl. Why not? She was always tender-hearted, Selena was, and I never ran up against a man as good at the poor me's as Joe was. He got inside her life, and once he was in there, he must have finally noticed just how pretty she was getting, and decided he wanted something more from her than just to have her listen when he talked, or hand him the next tool when he was head down in the engine compartment of some old junk truck. And all the time this was going on and the changes were happening, I was running around working about 4 different jobs and trying to stay far enough ahead of the bills to sock away a little each week for the kids' college educations. I never saw a thing until it was almost too late.